banger that is.
Oh my God. Play that in the club. I'll be there.
That was chosen by producer Caroline. It's called Joy, that track. Welcome, welcome to the Claire Solon podcast. I'm delighted to tell you that we're here with thanks to one of my favourite Irish brands, Sisterly, the multi-award winning multivitamin designed by women for women. Visit sisterlylab.com. So here we are. Oh, made it to episode 2. What a week it's been. Producer Caroline and I enjoyed a few margaritas to celebrate the launch of the podcast in London on Thursday evening. Bit of Mexican food, couple of margaritas, not too many because, well, you know, we had to come home and upload the podcast.
At an appropriate time.
Yeah, appropriate time, around 2:45 a.m. I think it went up in the end. I must have listened to episode 1 20 times. I know Eileen Solon has listened to it at least twice. And so many of you have been in touch to say you've also listened and you've really enjoyed it. And we just want to say thanks. Now, I have been thinking about starting this podcast, as I mentioned last week, for a long time. And one of the things that really had me stuck in the mud was the name. I was going round and round the houses and I was thinking about it. And I was like, what am I going to call this podcast? And every name I came up with was gone. And I thought, you know what? I just came around to my own name and I said, that's it. I can't think of anything smarter. I'm just going to go with the Claire Solon podcast. So last week, I put up a few posts on Instagram just to talk about the launch. And my cousin, my second cousin, Dee Woods, who works at Radio Nova in Dublin, got in touch. And, well, just listen to this.
Claire Solon, you are the life and soul. So why wouldn't you call your podcast The Life and Solon? The Life and Solon, get it?
The Life and Solon. We're sticking with the Claire Solon podcast because it's all over the artwork. But that is good. And I will be coming back to The Life and Solon in some shape or form at some point later this year. Dee Woods, as I mentioned, is on Radio Nova. You can catch her between 1 and 3 in the afternoons and on Friday night 80s as well. There you go, Dee. Gave you a little plug. So producer Caroline and I, as I mentioned, were over in London. And it just so happened, again, by chance, that you came over to London the same weekend that we were launching the pod. I went to work on the Saturday and you had the loveliest Saturday, didn't you, while I was slaving away?
Oh, I did. I do love London now for a little potter about the place. So it was great to have the opportunity to do so while you slaved away. So I went for a 2-hour massage. Beautiful, Eugene.
Not even one.
2 whole, full, complete hours.
The guy who did it for you is a guy called Eugene Sabala, S-A-B-A-L-A. If you are in London or you're coming to London, he's in Clapham Junction. You can look him up on his website. He is the perfect mix of pain and pleasure when it comes to massage. And he has done wonders for my body and many of my friends. So yeah, you had your 2-hour massage. Then where did you head then, Caroline?
Hopped on the train and went up to Selfridges. So I have a huge recommendation here for any of our gluten-free gals. Borough 22 Bakery in Selfridges. And I think I've tasted every single one of their delicacies by now. And they are all life-changing.
I mean, Selfridges, I think in the 11 years that I've been in London, I've probably been in Selfridges once. So by the sounds of it, you've probably been, you've lapped me several times.
Oh, yes. And you know what? Selfridges is a lovely little place, well, big place to go into just to have a mosey around the place.
Sure, it's like Brown Thomas, isn't it? It's beautiful. Yeah. If anyone's wondering, producer Kaz, she is the gluten-free hobnobber, which we often talked about on Soul Sisters.
She... I finally revealed myself.
So yeah, you went down to Selfridges, got your gluten-free snacks, and then we met after work. And we were on the train out to Gatwick and I was thinking to myself, now, geez, I better check in. And I could see you looking at me, Caroline, like, sorry, the flight is in, what, 2.5, 3 hours? But I have this strategy when it comes to checking in. I and David Ford, my mate, is a bit the same. We've worked out that if you check in for a flight quite close to takeoff, they'll often put you in the emergency exit seats. So that was my strategy. It massively backfired. Massively backfired. So I saw a screen on the Ryanair app that I had never seen before. It was the plane with no seating. Now, what did you think at that point as my body double?
Well, I thought a thought that I didn't want to think, which was, I've seen this before, not on Ryanair, but on other flights when I was off boarded. That's what was on my ticket as well. And I thought, Ryanair doesn't do that though.
Ryanair doesn't oversell a flight. It says get your seat at the gate, which I've never seen before. But we'll just go and we'll be positive. So we went to Joe and the Juice, didn't we? In Gatwick. We had ourselves a delicious juice to take our minds off it. What was in the juice again?
Well, we had Joe's Green Mile, it was called. So I looked it up and I said, how does one make Joe's Green Mile? And thank God for TikTok, because I found the recipe. 2 Granny Smith apples, 1 kiwi, a large handful of spinach, a tiny tree of broccoli, half an avocado, the juice of half a lemon, a little bit of ice, and some water to fill the bottom of your NutriBullet by about a quarter. Whiz it all up together and Bob's your uncle, you've got a Joe's Green Mile.
Now, I wouldn't generally spend my money on juices. I would probably go for a decaf or a coffee or a nice coffee or something. This was outstanding.
Yeah.
Really, really good. So if you are a juice gal and you fancy something chill and tasty, give it a go. So we slurped on our juices and we made our way to the gate. And as you know, it's peak summertime, so the place was absolutely heaving with folk, which did nothing for my anxiety, by the way. You probably heard me go real quiet. I was like, oh, angels, 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 please. So anyway, I got up to the desk all, you know, hey, and she goes, you've got no seat, stand aside. Caroline stands aside in solidarity with me. Everybody else, it felt like, went through, and it was just me, my body double, and a family of 3 who didn't have seats either. So anyway, the lady says to you, come on, you need to go through. So you're delaying, you're doing nothing for the Ryanair turnaround times. So you were hauled inside. And so so Ryanair were like, right, we have 3 seats and there are 4 of you. And the gentleman behind the desk called my name and said, Claire Solan, you're going on. And then he said very briskly to the family, 2 of you can get on, 1 of you can't. Now, at this point, the mother was on the verge of tears. The little girl was crying and the dad was really angry. So, oh God, the quandary. I see you sitting just beyond the desk inside, freedom. And then I see this family. So I turned to the Ryanair people and I said, let them go. Just let them go. I'll get on the next one. I'll get on the next one. The mother was beside herself, actually. She was so grateful. The dad threw me a tenner to get a cup of coffee. I waved goodbye to producer Cass. And I headed, because we were airside. I did not consider this. I did not consider the ramifications of giving up my seat. I thought it was just like, I'll get the next train, but it's not the same with planes. So the Ryanair lady was like, okay, come with me. I'll have to bring you, you know, out. And I thought, okay, right, to the other gate, obviously. No, no. And she's like, no. So what's going to happen is I'll walk you through the staff area. Then I have to walk you out through border control. And then you have to go back and do the process again. I had no idea. So she brings me through passport control. The passport control lady says, what's happened? And I said, Ryanair oversold the flight. And she went, ooh. I'm like, yeah, exactly. So Ryanair lady walks me out, leaves me at a desk. I talk to a woman who says, sorry, the 8:20 is sold out. You're going to have to wait for the 9:30. 2 hours away. I walk back around, like the most visceral moment of Groundhog Day I've ever experienced. Back to the Ryanair desk, check in, new boarding pass, back into security, put my bag through, and it gets pulled again. Because why? Angel cards. So your man comes and he's like, do you mind if I look in your bag? I was like, yeah, no problem. That's fine. It happened about an hour ago. Go ahead. And he pulls these out and he goes, these are the problem. And I said, what exactly is the problem with these? And he was like, they're very dense organic material.
Right.
It's like, okay, angels. Right.
That's exactly what angels are.
So I go and I queue up for the 9:30 flight and I'm sitting on the plane. I'm like, okay, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And then producer Kaz, who lives in Swords, very close to Dublin Airport, gives me a call and says, do not fight me on this. I will pick you up from the airport and I will drop you home. The dense organic angel came through for me.
There's no way that blue bus was coming to get you.
Oh, those blue buses from Dublin Airport. Sorry, but like they come every half an hour, if at all. So thank you, Caroline, for delivering me home to me ma. Can I just ask you before we move on, would you have done the same thing?
Yes.
Okay, good. Good.
Because you could see I was standing behind you at the point that you said to that family to go ahead. And I could see their pleading eyes. And then I just saw the relief in their faces. And I just thought, you've made the right decision there.
Big thanks to Sisterly, who are partnering with us on the podcast this season. The multi-award winning multivitamin designed by women for women. Each daily powder sachet gives you 23 essential nutrients to support energy, immunity, hair, skin and hormones. It tastes great with no sugars and the sachets are perfect on the go. Sisterly is a simple daily habit that supports long-term vitality rather than a quick fix. I have been taking it for more than a year and I've seen a real surge in my energy. I've been sleeping better, feeling more balanced, calmer, and more like myself. In there is magnesium, vitamin A, B6, B12, C and D, folate, zinc, copper, and hero ingredients such as CoQ10. Visit sisterlylab.com to discover Sisterly now and start elevating your everyday this summer. So I've got my first guest on the podcast this week and it's Sarah Tobin, who is somebody I've known for over 25 years. Sarah is an emotional freedom technique tapping practitioner and she's been helping mums all around the world using techniques that helped her after she lost her baby Alice a few days after birth. Sarah is an incredible woman. I have done many one-to-one sessions with her. She does ancestral healing. She does inner child work. She is a beautiful soul and she's written a beautiful book, which is almost a year old. It's called Tapping Into You. And producer Kaz, you got your hands on it, didn't you?
I sure did. Yeah. Tapping is something that I'd never done before, but the therapist in me was very curious about it. But also a little bit nervous because I find it hard to access my tears sometimes and it's been a big part of my journey. And so I sat down one day and decided to give one of the sequences a try. And by the time I got to the third statement, the tears were flowing and they flowed and flowed for quite some time. It was very cathartic and I felt a whole lot better for it as well. So amazing.
Wow, 5 stars for that experience. Good on you. That's not easy. Sarah and I, in our conversation today, talk about tapping, what it is and how it can help you in your hour of need. We talk about her grief at the loss of her baby, her husband Dave's grief, and also their love, how they first met. We also get into the good girl. Both Sarah and I are very much the good girl and have been all our lives. And we also talk about angels. So we kick off this conversation, though, by talking about what we have in common. Sarah and I both live in the UK. She lives down on the South Coast. We both went to DCU together and we studied business studies. And most remarkable of all, we were love rivals because we dated the same gentleman in college. So that's where we begin.
Lucky guy.
What a lucky man he was.
Yeah.
He'd probably also laugh at us now both describing him as a gentleman. I don't
think. Oh, yeah. Rascal.
He's a rascal. Exactly. He's one of life's funny rogues.
Yes.
And how was DCU for you? And I look back and say business studies was an interesting choice by me. And I don't even think it was a choice. How about for you?
Yeah, well, twofold. One was that it was the making of me in terms of friendships, because I struggled a lot in secondary school with friendships. So it was my first day. Oh, should have been now remembering this. First day on the way on the bus out of Dublin. I had to get the bus into Dublin and then the bus out. And I remember looking at the business prospectus beside a girl, Margaret McCarthy. And she looks over at the prospectus and goes, I'm doing that course too. And then from that moment, we were best friends and we just gathered people to us over the course of those weeks and still very, very close now. So from a friendship perspective, it was just life changing because I was able to be me. There were friends that I could choose and there was more fun and freedom. And that was incredible. Mm-hmm. From a course perspective, I mean, it wasn't really what I was wanted to do.
What, just before we move on, would it have been for you had you had your heart?
It was art college. So I remember walking around, is it Dunleary, the art college?
Yes.
And just thinking, wow, like I just loved, I felt it in my soul, but something sensible overrode that. And I don't know, that might have been the first time ever I had a very big intuitive nudge that I overrode in that way. And I probably was doing it a lot, to be honest. But I think that's the first very big split where I took the sensible path. But there's definitely a part of my soul just still loves the connection with art. And I've gone back to art class in recent years and done various bits and bobs. But definitely in the future, I think when I'm retired, I will have a little studio or paint the days away or something. I don't know. Something to look forward to.
Glorious. Is it the good girl in us that sends us on a path that is carved deeply into the road ahead?
Absolutely. I think there's a fear of letting other people down. We take on responsibility from others. The good girl belief runs deep. I think many an Irish Catholic woman has been trained and conditioned in a certain way, shaped and molded in many ways to keep us safe, I suppose, now thinking about it like from a parent perspective. But it really does have a lasting impact that can be really negative.
What is the wound for a good girl? Is it a mother wound?
I think it's an abandonment wound. And whether that comes from mum or dad or both, I think is dependent on each kind of person's childhood and situation. The mother relationship has a deeper scar, I feel, because that is the one we are most connected with energetically, biologically, intergenerationally. You know, we have the mother's milk, or we get fed by the mother, the bonding, the attention, the caregiving at that point in the early 80s was driven from the mother. So our needs and our attachments and our desires for love and care and security all, I suppose, would have been more heavily leaned into the mother. And so when that connection is not brilliant, or there's issues with mum, or there's any kind of separation from mum, either through illness, whether the child's ill, if the baby's born early through and put into NICU, even babies were sent overnight to the nurse's station, you know, rather than spending their first nights with their mother. Just so many different things that will impact that connection. And that's not the problem. The problem is that we internalize this situation because we don't have any other understanding of the world other than really what's right in front of us as babies. We interpret everything as our fault. So if we're crying in the middle of the night and no one comes, we've done something wrong. That's our fault. If mum's ill and has to be taken back to hospital and we're at home with the rest of the family. Mum's disappeared. That's my fault. So we internalize everything to try and make sense of it. And recently, I've just literally just this last week had three clients with blame, huge amount of blame. And blame is a protection tool. So if we blame ourselves, we don't have to connect with the depth of the feeling that we're feeling about a particular situation. So it's like a gatekeeper, but it prevents us from getting to grief, to anger that the situation even existed. And so it blocks away. We make it mean that something's wrong with us. We're different or we're difficult or we're not good enough. We're not worthy. We're not deserving. And then we shape our life around that.
Do these wounds show themselves again and again? And if we ignore them, I feel like when women give birth themselves and parenting becomes their first and foremost, that's when these wounds can really cause havoc.
Yeah, absolutely. You're birthing yourself as a mother and you start to piece together what you didn't receive in childhood. You're giving so much and you have a whole different perspective and a view. And I think we are probably most likely 30 plus years on from our own birth, and therefore parenting has changed massively and so on. But it's very obvious when we have a wound like that, how much of a gap we may have had in our own needs being supported, especially in terms of emotional support and safe space to be heard and encouragement to connect to our own feelings, rather than the denial and rushing through things and distraction as a tool, you know, like, oh, look, over here is a song, let's play this, rather than allowing me to cry and have my feelings. And then I also think that if we're running the I'm not good enough and I need to be perfect to be loved, it really, really drives a very anxious postpartum period, because we put all this pressure then on ourselves to be the perfect mother and to have everything perfect, as in the house, ourselves, our bodies, our child. And it just adds so much weight, so much pressure that I think no one can fulfill. I mean, there is no such thing as perfect. And we're all striving for something that is unattainable. And what does that do? It just kills you. It destroys you. It limits you. You sucks the life out of that lovely period that you're supposed to be having with your child, which then adds pressure again. So it's a vicious circle, I think. And the more you can work on your own inner narrative and belief about yourself and, you know, and your own anxieties and doubts and all that kind of stuff, I think the better. Many of us don't get to there before parenthood because we're busy living life and having fun and the crack and traveling and, you know, in love and so on. And then it hits. So that can all hit as one big, huge change. And then so much, I suppose, gets taken away or reawoken within you. And it can be hard.
It seems to me it's so crucial to watch the stories we're telling ourselves.
Surrender is the word that came to me. You know, I feel like my life is just one big constant flow of surrender. Every time I think I have a plan or I want control over something, something will come along to go say, you know, your plans are great, but this is the direction you're going now. And as you know, I have a constant thing where I'm on eggshells at home, often because of my son's disability, I suppose you would say. And it's just a daily reminder to just let go and that I cannot control a damn thing. As much as I have visions and dreams, and that's all great, you have to kind of have them with a pinch of salt. It's like, life will go where it's meant to go. And if you just surrender and go with the flow, I think life is going to be so much easier.
Totally agree. And I think when I got to grips with that word surrender with my coach and mentor, Dennis, many years ago, and as you say, surrendering daily, sometimes hourly.
Yeah.
I remember traveling to India and for some reason I had gotten through Heathrow on an out of date visa. Oh. And I'd been working big time on the surrender. So this was probably my ultimate test. So I was going to fly from Abu Dhabi out to Delhi. And I got as far as Abu Dhabi. And the man said to me, literally just about to board the plane, this is out of date, this visa. And you know that moment in your head, you're thinking, that's definitely the most recent visa I have. So I just stepped out of the queue and I started going through my phone and I could feel the well of like, oh God, this, how, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. Do I have to go back to Heathrow? But then also a calmness came over me and like a belief, I am where I'm supposed to be. For some reason, there is a massive lesson to be learned here.
Wow.
And I must learn it. So I stepped aside. I could not find another visa. I went and stayed in a hotel for 3 days in Abu Dhabi. And then eventually I got a new visa issued. But it was the greatest reminder I've had, I suppose, to date, that accept and move.
Yes.
Accept and move.
Acceptance is another massive one that I have to work with people on. Acceptance is another damn blocker. Not accepting the new story. Say, for example, a victim of abuse or something. They don't want the story that I'm a victim. They don't want to have been a victim. They don't want that experience is their life now. And the longer that they spend denying that they are the victim, the more they disconnect they will have internally and the harder and longer they will suffer, you know, internally with the emotions because they're not letting themselves get to the grief of it because it's a protection method as well. So blame and acceptance really hold us back. So when we can actually get to acceptance and just go, okay, this is me now. This is part of my story. I'm going to use it and learn from it. That makes you able to move forward.
I'd like to speak to you about Alice, your daughter, your firstborn.
Yeah.
And speaking about acceptance, this accepting Alice's fate must have been unthinkable. Tell us about her.
Yeah. So November 2014, I had her, birthed her. And everything up to then had gone really, really well. Really nice first pregnancy. And it was just the final stages of labor where I think either cord compression or she was stuck or something went wrong and she didn't get the oxygen that she needed. It wasn't identified early enough and we had to go through a lot of 3.5 years, in fact, of lawyers and mediation and expert witness opinions on everything just to kind of really get clear on that. But there was definitely a window where I think up to 10 minutes prior, she would have been okay. So as you can imagine, just the biggest shock to our system. I don't think I've ever felt like that before or since, you know, the like world falling away, like just literally everything, all the visions, all the plans, everything just fell away. And it ripped my heart. I said something the other day, I was like, I never understood the word heartbreak. I never understood the pain of it really until I felt it as a, like I had a, there was like an invisible knife wedged in my heart for 3 months afterwards. Every single day there was that like physical pain. I'd never fully experienced that, luckily. And I know some people do a lot. But yeah, it was just absolutely horrendous. And you wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. And so I have really struggled over the years watching families being destroyed in Gaza and so on. I just find it too heartbreaking because I know that pain. And I find it, I've found it very hard to witness. And at times I've not been able to engage much because it's just too raw, you know, which is understandable, but equally I feel guilty about it too. But, you know, people lose their children all over the world in various ways. And I suppose we were lucky. We had 5 days with her alive. So she didn't just die straight away. We had her on life support. We had her in the NICU. She was on cooling. They did everything that they could to try and see, was there any possibility of life? And there just wasn't. So we had to make a decision to take her off life support. And that process was horrendous too. Never, ever think that you'd have to go through anything like that as a first time mom. And back then, I didn't know anybody that had been through anything like that. It wasn't in my awareness. I wasn't prepared for it at all, which you should, and you shouldn't. No one should prepare for that kind of thing, you know? We don't need any more anxiety than we already have on top of everything else. The lesson of surrender and acceptance has been very well and truly learned and continued, you know, like there's constant lessons, but that is how I found what I do. That is what led me to shifting a career, to supporting women, to knowing myself so much better, to support myself in so many different ways, and to have met so many amazing people. So, you know, the acceptance has come with gratitude for her as a spirit guide, which I do believe she is, and for all the amazing things that I've done since.
We'll come back to Alice and your chorus of angels, but I just wanted to speak about Hamnet.
Oh.
You wrote a beautiful post on Instagram around the time of its release, and the post went viral. And if you're okay, I'd love to read just a passage from it. As Agnes screamed in deep grief and pain on screen, I couldn't help but think, I never got to do that. So many people were crying around me in the cinema, yet it was all so silent, so polite. That's what it felt like to grieve our daughter Alice after she passed away. Silent, polite. There was no roar from the depths of my being. There was no writhing in pain at the unfairness of our loss. No thrashing, hitting or lashing out. It was dignified, stifled, repressed. I thought, how lucky she was to do that right at that moment, so she didn't have to carry it around. That is, that's raw, Sarah, but that is, like, I'm with you on every single word of that.
Yeah, I was deeply moved. It was an uncomfortable watch, but so powerful because it led to so many conversations, didn't it? It led to a huge amount of deep connection with people. And I just found, the way the whole thing was done was just incredible.
I also loved the fact that you told us you did actually get that scream eventually. Could you tell us how you managed to process that?
Oh, goodness. That grief? Killery?
Killery.
Yeah. So it was a couple of Septembers ago. And I hosted a retreat in Connacht in the west coast of Ireland. Beautiful location. And I brought in this young, gorgeous girl, Mary, who is a breath worker, to lead us through some kind of deep transcendental breath work. And I walked in there saying, let go. I knew that whole weekend there was something brewing. And I even, as the retreat host, you know, in previous situations, I have not let myself go. And this time around, I was like, you have permission to let whatever comes, come. So I went in with that intention, and I've never done anything breathwork like it, to be honest, at that point. And it came from my womb as a ripple, and I mean a physical ripple, like a wave that came from the womb first and then moved up and through me and out of me. And I had a pillow, I was screaming into it. And it equally, I was so aware of everyone else, but I was trying to really let myself honor the depths of that and to let it really come out. And once I settled again, it was amazing. I was kind of, this might sound really weird, but a part of me was like up in the room on the wall with wings. It was like I was looking down on myself, and I could feel angelic presence, whether it was me or another angelic presence or Alice, I don't know. But it was like, almost like I was quite happy there. I didn't even want to come back into the body, you know, it was like free and light. But anyway, we were all brought back safely and I did come back into my body. And yeah, I felt very honored that I was able to do that with the amazing women that were there. Obviously, I know knew them all, and I knew that I wouldn't be judged and I would be supported. So the whole thing was just really beautiful, but uncomfortable. Yeah, like that, you know, grief is uncomfortable. Raw emotion is uncomfortable, but it's not permanent. That's the thing we forget, isn't it? The more we can actually connect to the feeling of it, the quicker it moves through us. Depression is actually, I feel, just a disconnection from feeling. So we're just avoiding the feeling that actually if we felt, we would feel a whole lot better from. And the bills, the depression bills, and it can last a long time because it's our protector, again, trying to distract us from the pain.
Pushing it down rather than letting it up. And, you know, I've been talking lately a lot about tears and really trying to normalize the tears that we shed, like when we sweat, if we sauna or we exercise.
Yeah.
It's a removal of stagnant energy, of emotion, of toxins that need to go. And if they don't go, you harden up and you become easily triggered and defensive and angry.
Yeah. We have choices all the time. And we have a choice to choose happiness or to choose sadness, to choose peace or chaos, gratitude or ignorance, you know? And I distinctly remember early days post Alice, I decided to have a couple of days in bed watching Netflix. And at this point, I was drinking a lot. I was like 5 or 6 every afternoon, I was opening a bottle of wine because I was trying to numb what was going on. And I'd given myself these days in bed and I woke up and I was like, I can't keep doing that. Like, there is nothing good that is going to come from me sitting here, lying in bed, wallowing. And I realized then that that was a choice that I could make, a choice that I could make to either stay in bed and wallow, disassociate and avoid, or find some way to move forward with this as my new normal. You know, that was kind of what I had to figure out. My life is different now. And how do I make this my new normal? How do I live with this as my story? And that was just a very, very conscious decision that I feel might be useful for others to know, you know?
So helpful. And you've kind of brought me nicely on to what I was going to ask you about next, which is your lovely husband, Dave, who we'll talk about where you met him in a moment, because I know, like me and all the other single gals out there, we love to hear a meet cute. but let's talk first about the different ways in which partners and husbands and wives grieve. How did you and Dave, did you come together? Did you go...
Very separate, you know. God, we were so young as well. Like, I was 33, he was 31, nearly 32, you know, not long married. You know, we're now together like nearly 20 years this year. So we had no clue who we were independently, really, before this thing happened, you know, this tragedy. Dave suppressed a lot. He's becoming a lot more vocal about how he feels about things, but it wasn't natural to him then. And he used exercise and kite surfing and water sports, throwing himself into new things as a way of getting peace, I suppose. So he would find peace in the water, he'd find peace in his run. And that's what he did. And I knew I needed support, and I found an EFT practitioner eventually that could support me, and, you know, massively changed my life as a result. Dave now, in recent years, he had an event where he ended up going back to the pub that we had Alice's funeral in after the crematorium. And that hit him hard, seriously hard. And he had no idea that that was in there. No idea. And so he's gone on a bit of a journey trying to connect more. He's even done some tapping with my friend Eddie to kind of use his voice more because it was just not natural to him. He was very supportive of me and would have done anything, but we definitely internalized it after a while. At the beginning, it was we were very close and tight. We actually have this piece of art on the wall. It's some lettering by Lola Hode. She was an amazing illustrator living in Brighton for a while at the time. And it was a phrase that we used in the hospital from day one. And I don't know where this came from, but it basically says stronger together. And we kept saying that to each other in the hospital over those 5 days and in those early weeks. And I said, so we have it at the end of our bed so we can remind ourselves that we're stronger together.
You met Dave when you were traveling the world. Tell us how you met him.
So all my friends were coupled up in early 20s and I was like, but I want to travel. So I got a job in New Zealand and I went off and I did that for 9 months, 10 months. And I had around the world tickets. So on the way back, I flew into Chile and I booked a hostel called La Chimba in Santiago. And the first day I got there, I remember I still can see it now, walking down the stairs of the hostel and he was signing in and paying up for his night or two. And I noticed, so he was British, shaved head, built like a tank. And there was another guy with him. And then there was an Irish guy with, so another English guy and an Irish guy. And so anyway, I went over and introduced myself to the three lads. I was like, just
good
arrived.
Girl.
Yeah. I've already clocked one of you to be my husband. And they invited me to dinner. They were cooking a big spag ball that evening in the hostel. Did I want to join them? I was like, yeah. So I came along and then that was that. We were just snogging by 12 o'clock or something. And then we went in different directions. We had different things planned. And then we met back up again in La Paz in Bolivia and traveled together for 2 weeks. And then I had to fly home. I had my ticket. Oh, just before I left there, I left all my money and my cards in the taxi. So I had I had to borrow money from Dave. He had to ring his mom, say, I've met a girl. She's Irish. Yeah, very nice. She's also lost all her money and needs to fly home. Can't get to the airport. Can we lend her some money? So one of the first things I had to do when I got home was like send the money to his mom. So I came home and he stayed on for another 3 months, but every week he Skyped me and not one week did he miss it. When you think back with all the stuff that happens and goes on traveling, he showed up. And then after that, he flew to Dublin in the March. Then it was back and forth. And then I moved over in the November.
Was there any debate out of interest about whether it would be Dublin or London? Or were you
he
just
did
like,
come
go?
To Ireland and tried to get a job. And I've never seen him so depressed, like in my whole life. I think it rained the whole time he was with us for 2 weeks. Terrible interviews. He just hated everything about it. We're much better near on the south coast of the UK in the sunshine and his family's close as well.
Well, look, Lexi, you have two sons. So you went on to give birth to Casper and to Josh.
Yes.
And you've mentioned EFT or tapping. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this because this really is, frustratingly, I'm sure for you and others, a really well-kept secret. And I think it's time that we all knew how this emotional freedom technique can help us get away from stress and anxiety. Mm-hmm. But tell me, how did it find you and what is it?
I was having flashbacks. And in hindsight, I had a psychological review as part of the hospital process we were going through. And the psychologist said I had severe undiagnosed PTSD. So I didn't even know. The hospital, when I left after giving birth and losing Alice, didn't even mention PTSD. Here's not a leaflet to something to like look out for, you know, get support, nothing like that. So I was getting flashbacks at work. I was also pregnant again. I, you know, managed to get to the 12-week mark, breathing deeply and actually then the anxiety kicked in more because I was like, oh God, this is actually happening. Now I have to give birth. So now there's like a timeline on getting my shit together. And I found that that was really stressful. I remember talking to my sister on the phone about the flashbacks and she said, she didn't tell me at the time. She said, oh, I went to see an EFT practitioner because she'd had some car crashes. She'd had a few little knocks that were causing her flashbacks as well. And I was like, oh, okay, what's that? And I looked it up and I was like, oh. And I just, as soon as I read about it, I was like, okay, yeah, this is it. This is what I need. And I found a local practitioner called Kate Marilat, who hosted my book launch last August in lovely kind of synchronicity. And she was just phenomenal. And after that first session, I came out and I was like, this is something else. Like, this is something I've never experienced before. I've done talk therapies and counseling and so on, and it doesn't touch the sides for me. Whereas this was deeply somatic. The tears I cried were deeper than any I've been able to cry prior. And the relief of crying them was different too. Like, I've cried and not felt better for it. But this was like, oh, I feel a lot better for this. So EFT, Emotional Freedom Technique, is a self-administered tool that tells the brain and the body to switch off the fight, flight, freeze response. So our stress response, where we're producing adrenaline and cortisol. You know, if we're in a constant state of stress and high levels of cortisol and adrenaline, it's causing illness in a serious way. So tapping on your body in various places, which is a link to ancient Chinese medicine. We've known about these points on the body for 3,000 years, paired with the modern psychology of actually just talking about how you're feeling, acknowledging, witnessing, owning, accepting, honoring, forgiving, is the part of the process while tapping that ultimately lets the energy move through the body. So you unlock the dam, as we talked about earlier, and the river can flow again. So basically it's the energy in our system can get back to doing what it's supposed to be doing. Ultimately, tapping brings us safety. And many of us have not felt safe our whole lives, not truly safe, not truly supported, not truly loved, because the environment we were in was unable to provide that for whatever reason. And there's no blame or shame when we think about our parents, because they obviously couldn't give us what they never received either. Anytime I work with somebody, it's like we focus on mitigating blame and shame. We're not trying to assign it to anybody. So when you can access the pain created by the experience, you can allow and work with the ego or the protector or the part of you that's created that to dissolve that old belief, because that belief isn't required anymore. And that belief was often created as a misinterpretation. It's not truth, right? So at the age of 7, I'm not able to realize that my mum's postpartum experience was horrendous and she's on antidepressants and it's nothing to do with me. It's hormonal and grief and all these other things that she's experiencing. But I'm blaming myself. I'm not good enough. I've done something wrong. We go back to the inner child. We talk to her. We tell her what was going on. She's like, oh, you mean I don't have to believe this anymore? No, you don't. And then it starts to collapse and the energy starts to move. And you can then create new beliefs and focus on those instead.
It's not our fault that something happened to us, but we are responsible to heal it.
Yeah.
And I think my relationship changed fundamentally with my parents when I stopped pointing a finger and blaming them for the feelings that I had never acknowledged or processed myself properly.
Yeah.
And I know you and I have done several sessions together and they have been transformative. One in particular, the last one we did together, we were actually communicating with me in the womb, Sarah. It was me right back there, which was very powerful.
I adore my one-to-one work. It's life-changing. I work with women usually in 6-session packages, where it's deep, transformative. We do the inner child. We might do the birth. We might look at past life stuff. We'll look at ancestral trauma. We'll look at so many different things, all with the view of letting go of the chains to the past so that you can really fully step into your authentic self now and start living properly with more awareness, more gratitude, more inner connection, more inner peace. That comes from just letting go. And well, basically, none of us know how to do that. And that's why this tool is so effective, because it's actually a physical, life-changing letting go tool.
Certainly under your guidance, I so enjoyed my sessions. So if this speaks to you, do get in touch with Sarah. Sarah_Tobin on Instagram is a good place to start. So before we finish up, it would be remiss of me not to bring the angels in. Georgie and I did a series of Soul Sisters not so long ago. And as G always says, there's a theme to each season. And this season was absolutely the angelic realm. How do they show up for you?
I think my mom went on her own healing journey. So in my teenage years, I was reading Louise Hay and Doreen Virtue, and she had angel cards in the house. So I would always have, I learned the names of the angels from that. I felt very connected to Michael. So I would have asked for protection from him. And then at 18, I studied Reiki. And by 21, I was a Reiki master. So I worked with angels in that way, in an energetic way. Now, I didn't ever really see clients, but it was a very powerful healing tool for me. I had multiple healing sessions with people energetically, and many of them saw Alice as my guide. Now, I actually believe that Alice was my guide before she came in. So she's been with me. I think we've had many lifetimes together as sisters, different setups. And I now fully believe, and have done for a long time, that she volunteered to be Alice the baby in this life to wake me up and shift my trajectory back to my purpose, which is supporting people and honoring our experiences and giving people tools to thrive in life. And so I connect with her a lot. And there's many a month or a week, few weeks that will go past, and I don't think of her at all. And I don't berate myself for that, because I know that she doesn't need me, right? So I got a message from her fifth birthday, was that from her, that was like that she's happy, she's doing her thing, she is where she's meant to be, and that there's no pull from those on the other side. They don't have a need for us the way we have a need for them. And I thought that was just such a nice message to receive. It's like, oh, so I don't have to think of you all the time. Like literally, that if I call, she's there. But she doesn't have a pull or a need for me. My connection with the spirit world has just slowly but naturally become closer. Like the veil has thinned for me. Whereas prior to Alice, I would not be able to get a sense of any of that. I would never have felt any connection to that world. So the work I've done has brought me back to myself in so many ways, because it's brought me back to like a spiritual, a soul, deep, deep soul connection. And yeah, I love connecting with the angelic realm.
Sarah, what a pleasure it has been.
Thank you.
Thank you, honey.
Chatting with you. It's the best.
Me too.